Players spoke English most of the time to ensure that no one felt left out, but occasionally the international players would switch things up, boosting both camaraderie and tactical advantage. Two French players, Tony Parker and Boris Diaw, turned to their native language when they needed to communicate quickly on the court. The two Australians on the team, Patty Mills and Aaron Baines, often spoke to each other in their own dialect. In teamwork, diversity encourages members, whether they're in the majority or the minority, to search for new information and novel viewpoints, and to process that information more deeply and accurately, which leads to better decision-making and problem-solving. Just being exposed to diversity changes the way we think. In a 2006 study, undergrads at the University of Illinois were assigned to work in three-person same-gender groups on a murder mystery task in which sharing information was the key to success. Some of the groups had only white members, other groups had two white members and one non-white person, Asian, African American, or Hispanic. Information was shared among all members of a group, but each was also given key clues to the mystery that only he or she had. To correctly identify the murderer, members had to share all the information they collectively had during their discussion. The diverse groups were more successful. Being with others who are similar, the results suggest, leads us to think that we all have the same information, which discourages engagement. Differences in beliefs and personal preferences also bring benefits. In one study, 186 people who identified as either a Democrat or a Republican worked on the same murder mystery task I just told you about and decided who they thought committed the crime. Next, each person wrote an essay about their suspicion in preparation for a meeting with another group member. Participants were told that their partner disagreed with their opinion. Their task was to change his or her mind. Half of the participants were told their partner supported the opposing political party, and half were told the person supported their own party. The results showed that Democrats didn't prepare as well for meetings with Democrats as they did for meetings with Republicans, and the same pattern was true for Republicans. In general, people who anticipate joining ethnically or politically diverse groups are more thorough in their preparation. Whether we are trying to solve a murder mystery, come up with creative solutions to complex problems, enter new markets, develop new products, or improve workflow, diversity can challenge our thinking in constructive ways. Even before we begin to interact with others in a diverse group, the simple fact of diversity promotes better preparation, more creativity, and deeper thinking by encouraging us to consider a range of viewpoints. We may not enjoy the decision-making process as much because of the greater effort required, but in the end, we'll usually reach a better outcome than a less diverse group would have produced. When organizations and their leaders commit to diversity, the benefits are deep and wide. But increasing diversity in an organization often requires leaders to fight attitudes and practices that are holding their employees back. Rebels help their organizations reap the benefits of greater diversity by focusing on how to best leverage differences. Rebels recognize that initiatives to increase or effectively manage diversity often fail because they treat the issue as a problem rather than as an opportunity. Rebels know that to effectively leverage differences, their organizations should work beyond race and gender. In the rebel mind, all differences matter. Diversity is not a quota system, it's a long-range vision for growth. When Ava DuVernay was starting her new career, she spent a lot of her energy trying to figure out how to break into the filmmaking business. She sought out people who could advise her, give her support, and show her the way to success. Eventually, though, she realized that in doing this, she was wearing a coat of desperation, and would be better off making her own films, with her own ideas, on her own budget. She told Time magazine, "I think there have been cracks made in the glass ceiling by women who can get close enough to hit it, but I'm mostly bolstered by folks who create their own ceilings." By following their dreams, women and minorities can change their organizations and inspire others to do the same. By finding a way to ignore the barriers that others may create for them, intentionally or not, rebels like DuVernay create their own ceiling, one set only by their own potential. Chapter 6. Coach Cheeks Sings the National Anthem, A Talent for Authenticity. No one man can, for any considerable time, wear one face to himself and another to the multitude, without finally getting bewildered as to which is the true one. Nathaniel Hawthorne, The Scarlet Letter. On the night of April 25, 2003, 20,000 eager basketball fans streamed into the $267 million Rose Garden Arena in Portland, Oregon, for the third game between the Portland Trailblazers and the Dallas Mavericks in the first round of the NBA Western Conference playoffs. The Blazers had won 13 of 15 games against the Mavericks in Portland, but the Mavericks already owned a 2-0 lead in the best-of-seven series. The first two games had been played in Dallas, and now the Blazers were back on their home court. Excitement and tension were high, but the raucous crowd quieted for the singing of the national anthem. 13-year-old Natalie Gilbert would do the honors as winner of the Trailblazers' Get the Feeling of a Star promotion. She had woken up with the flu that day, but the aspiring Broadway star knew the show had to go on. Gilbert stood before a massive American flag, all dressed up in a black and white sparkly prom dress, rhinestones glittering on her neck, her blonde hair pulled up in a topknot. Facing the thousands of amped-up fans and millions of TV viewers, she took a last look around the arena, raised the microphone, and began to sing in a mellow alto, "Oh, Say Can You See?" At first, Gilbert showed the poise of a pro, but when she hit the second line, she stumbled, singing Starlights instead of Twilights. She broke off and nervously chuckled, then tossed her head from side to side, trying to shake off the mistake. But she couldn't. She raised her right hand and covered her face with the mic as embarrassment set in. The music continued, but Gilbert, shaking her head, appeared on the verge of tears. The crowd's encouragement was for naught. She had lost her composure. Out of ideas, she looked to her right, then behind her, searching for her father, Vince, but with no luck. Gilbert was all alone. In just a few excruciating seconds, her dream had turned into a nightmare. Blazers head coach Maurice Cheeks, standing near the bench in a gray suit and tie, had been focused on the game, one of the biggest of his coaching career. But he quickly strode over to Gilbert. The 46-year-old coach gently put his arm around her, helped her raise the mic, and began singing the words at Gilbert's side. She regained her confidence, no longer alone. Cheeks gestured to the crowd, leading the 20,000-strong choir in a patriotic sing-along. By the end, the voices of players, coaches, and fans soared as one behind the home of the brave. The Trailblazers lost that night. They fought hard to win the next three games, tying the series, but fell in the seventh game. Yet Cheeks is remembered less for those nail-biter wins and losses than for his moment as an on-court savior. Ministers praised him as the very definition of a good Samaritan. Gilbert called him her guardian angel. Cheeks told the New York Times, "I never thought about doing it before I did it. I just saw a little girl in trouble, and I went to help her. I'm a father. I have two kids myself. I'd have wanted someone to help them if they could." In 2005, Patricia Feely Crucial, an executive vice president at AOL Time Warner, was about to deliver an important speech to her staff. For months, she had been working to bring flex time to the company. More and more people, she thought, valued flexibility in their work, and she worried that AOL Time Warner was in danger of losing the war for talent because they didn't have a flex time policy. But she was having trouble getting colleagues to take the idea seriously. Many worried that flex time would be abused. So Feely Crucial had decided to run a flex time pilot program with her own group of about 5,000 employees. In the speech, she was going to explain the pilot to the entire staff. She needed and wanted to make the strongest case possible. But she was also thinking a lot about her teenage daughter, who had been struggling that year. Feely Crucial was planning to hire a therapist to work with her daughter, and she had also sought permission to work from home during the coming summer so that they could spend more time together. She asked herself, "Should I mention this to the staff?" It would be risky. Her employees might judge her for her daughter's problems, wondering if perhaps she was to blame for having focused more on her career than on her child. Feely Krushel took the stage and outlined the value of flex time for employees. Using flex time, she said, would not keep them from getting ahead. Taking a deep breath, she explained that although this wasn't the reason she was advocating for the program, she would be the first employee to take advantage of it. She needed to be with her daughter. "We are all human beings," Feely Krushel said, "and things happen in life we can't always control." Feely Krushel's flex time pilot turned out to be a success. The program was eventually rolled out to other groups in the company, and it ultimately helped with hiring and retention. Feely Krushel's worries about being judged gave way to a strong sense that her openness had resonated with her staff. "We all hesitate before making ourselves vulnerable, fearful of being judged by others, but these worries are usually misplaced. Opening up wins us trust, perhaps even more so when it involves showing weaknesses, whether an off-key voice, as in the case of Maurice Cheeks, or a personal problem, as with Feely Krushel. Revealing our deepest emotions takes courage, which inspires emulation and admiration in the people around us, and allows them to connect with us more quickly and more profoundly. Rebels understand all of this. They are willing to stand naked in front of others. Sharing personal information is key to developing and maintaining strong relationships. When we do, our peers trust and like us more, and also feel closer to us. In addition, self-disclosure makes us feel and appear more real. For one study, my colleagues and I invited college students to the lab and paired them up for computer chats. Participants asked to disclose their flaws got a more positive response from their partners. Next, during a game that required trust, the participants who disclosed their weaknesses outperformed their more circumspect peers. Even a star stands to gain from the occasional slip. When Jennifer Lawrence was named Best Actress for her role in Silver Linings Playbook at the 2013 Academy Awards, she tripped and fell as she climbed to the stage in her pink ball gown. She looked mortified, but the crowd gave her a standing ovation. "You guys are just standing up because you feel bad that I fell," she joked in her acceptance speech. "That's really embarrassing." Psychologist Elliot Aronson has identified what he calls the pratfall effect. In one of his experiments, Aronson trained a paid actor to act as a quiz show contestant. Students listened to the recording of the actor answering a series of extremely difficult questions and getting almost all of them correct. He then described his highly successful academic career. For some students, the recording ended. For others, it continued, and the students could hear the actor knocking over a cup of coffee on himself. The students who heard the spill judged him to be more likable. "We find it hard to relate to people who are highly competent, but we tend to warm to those who are flawed, because we know that we are too." The psychologist Joanne Sylvester has found that job candidates who admitted past mistakes during interviews were actually more appealing to employers than those who covered them up. "When we own our blunders, people are impressed." In May 2015, I saw this happen in person, when Intuit co-founder Scott Cook delivered an unexpected sort of commencement address to the graduating MBAs at Harvard Business School, his alma mater. Cook was following in the footsteps of many other distinguished business leaders, including Facebook COO Sheryl Sandberg. Cook, who now serves as the chairman of the executive committee of Intuit, had earned an MBA from HBS in 1976. He worked as a brand manager at Procter & Gamble and then with the corporate strategy consulting firm Bain, taking on assignments in banking and technology. A few years later, Cook and his wife Signe moved to Silicon Valley when the software explosion was at its peak. He was in his early 20s. One day, the two were sitting at their kitchen table when Cook saw Signe writing out checks one after the other. Cook started thinking that there had to be a simpler way to pay the bills. Why not create software to handle household finances? That question eventually led to Intuit Inc. and the creation of leading financial software products like TurboTax, Quicken, QuickBooks, and Mint. Starting from nothing in 1983, the company is now a $5 billion giant with over 8,000 employees. 908 members of the MBA class of 2015 were awaiting their well-deserved degrees after 2 long years of classes, group projects, and internships, and yes, a lot of parties at the end. With their families and friends, they were sitting under a warm sun and blue sky on the Baker lawn of the HBS campus, ready to hear an inspiring speech that would assure them that they could do pretty much anything if they applied themselves. But then something unexpected happened. Cook spoke to them about his failures. He said, "I realized I was holding the company back. I could feel in my gut that there were a lot of duties I had to do that I didn't enjoy, nor was I good at doing them." Cook recalled that when his limitations as a chief executive first dawned on him, Intuit was flying high, a market leader expanding into the UK after a successful IPO. And yet the man at the top worried that he was in over his head, that he didn't have the skills the company needed at the helm, and that he didn't know how to tackle its most pressing problems. Cook ultimately decided to step down. It was a decision he should have made much earlier, he told the crowd. He had failed to develop as a leader, and he had let the company down. As the only person in the company who didn't receive a performance review during his time as CEO, Cook had sought out an executive coach and asked for a 360-degree evaluation. The results were poor, but rather than hiding them, he shared the feedback with employees. He told the HBS students, "I went to colleagues and said, 'This is what I've heard. I'm going to fix it. Please help me.'" That a person at his level was willing to admit to his flaws and even ask for help from people below him on the corporate ladder was, needless to say, uncommon. After receiving a long, warm applause, Cook was swarmed by graduates who wanted to hear more. Such is the power of authenticity. In a recent study, a team of Harvard researchers demonstrated that it is also a good idea to show weaknesses in the context of pitch competitions, where entrepreneurs give fast pitches, short presentations of a minute or two, before a panel of investors. The investors then judge the entrepreneurs and award capital to the winners. The study focused on one actual pitch competition. In it, after entrepreneurs had made their presentations, but before the results were revealed, they listened to a recording of what they believed to be a fellow competitor's pitch and were told that they would be asked to evaluate this competitor. Some listened to a recording in which the entrepreneur only discussed successes. For example, the entrepreneur stated, "I have already landed some huge clients, companies like Google and GE. I've had amazing success, and in the past year, I have single-handedly increased our market share by 200%. Other entrepreneurs listened to the same recording, but then heard the speaker reveal her failures. "I wasn't always so successful. I had a lot of trouble getting to where I am now. When I started my company, I also failed to demonstrate why potential clients should believe in me and our mission. Many potential clients turned me down." When they heard the entrepreneur describe her successes and her failures, rather than only the former, listeners felt less envious and more motivated to work hard to improve their own ventures. Discussing failure in the classroom can also be inspiring and motivating to students, and research has shown that it usually results in higher grades. For example, the following details are worth mentioning when we study a genius like Einstein. As a boy, Albert Einstein saw his father struggle to provide for his wife and children, moving the family from place to place as he looked for work. Having to change schools was difficult for Albert. Not only did he constantly feel out of place, but he was always playing catch-up in class. It's not just success that inspires others to greatness. Sometimes, in fact, it's just the opposite. About 400 freshmen and sophomores at a low-income, mostly non-white high school were asked to read stories about Einstein, Marie Curie, or Michael Faraday. The stories, each just 800 words, focused on one of three themes. The story of a successful scientist was about great accomplishments, winning Nobel Prizes, publishing groundbreaking papers, or pioneering new fields of study. Trying over and over again, even when you fail, focused on intellectual and professional struggle, including failed experiments. Overcoming the challenges in your life covered personal ordeals, such as dealing with poverty or discrimination. 6 weeks after the students read the stories, the researchers asked the teachers how the students were doing in science class. The answer was that the students who had read about struggle, whether intellectual or personal, now had higher grades than their peers who had read about achievements. The differences were especially pronounced in students who weren't getting good grades to begin with, suggesting that this exercise may be most beneficial to those most in need of help. Understanding the scientists' struggles helped the students see them as role models. In another study, researchers found that exposing firefighters to case studies of experienced firefighters who committed errors brought better performance in a post-training task as compared to case studies where there were no errors. And in research I conducted with colleagues, we examined data from 71 surgeons who completed more than 6,500 cardiac procedures over the course of 10 years and found that surgeons learned more from others' failures than from others' successes, and that this vicarious learning reduced patient mortality. In early 2016, after posting a revised CV on his professional website, Princeton University professor Johannes Haushofer became a kind of folk hero of failure. In this CV of failures, he listed the many positions and awards for which he had applied and been rejected. When asked about the revision, Haushofer gave a simple explanation to the Washington Post, saying, "Most of what I try fails, but these failures are often invisible while the successes are visible. I have noticed that this sometimes gives others the impression that most things work out for me. As a result, they are more likely to attribute their own failures to themselves, rather than the fact that the world is stochastic, applications are crapshoots, and selection committees and referees have bad days." We are always looking for ways to hide, whether by covering up aspects of our personality, keeping our emotions to ourselves, or concealing our fears and flaws. But vulnerability helps us create stronger connections with others. Listening to Maurice Cheek's voice as he led Gilbert through the anthem, you'd have never mistaken him for a great singer. Nobody cared. The audience joined in because of the connection he had made. We worry that rejection awaits those who reveal their true selves. To connect, we try our best to appear perfect, strong, intelligent, and polished, without realizing that this strategy often has the opposite effect. When I first arrived in the United States back in 2001, I shared a Boston apartment with two roommates, both Americans, who were just a few years older and who had been living together for 2 years. The day I moved in, they invited me to join them for dinner. One of them told me, "We were thinking of taking it easy and just ordering Chinese. That's what we often do on Sundays." "Sure," I said, "that would be great." Chinese is not my favorite, but I was pleased to be asked to join them and didn't mention it. Chinese takeout became a Sunday tradition in our apartment, and one that I grew to dread. I vividly remember the night my roommates added spicy chicken feet to the usual dishes. My roommate pointed out, "There's not much food on the foot itself, but you can eat the tendons off the bones." I couldn't bring myself to put anything on my plate. Eventually, my roommate served me. I slowly played with the food, taking small bites and swallowing almost without chewing. This, I thought, isn't working. It may seem harmless to fake it, especially in a context as relatively unimportant as what to order for dinner, but it's not. Our self-esteem, job performance, and relationships all take a hit. Small challenges seem bigger. We hesitate to speak up. Our health suffers. The more inauthentic we feel, the higher our stress, the lower our sense of well-being, and the more prone we are to burnout. Think about a time in your personal or professional life when you behaved in a way that made you feel untrue to yourself. My colleagues and I asked participants in a study to write about such a moment. We asked another group to write about their last visit to the grocery store, an experience we assumed would be somewhat neutral. After writing about inauthentic behavior, participants felt more anxious and less moral than those who wrote about their last visit to the grocery store. They wanted to clean themselves. There are other, subtler costs of pretending. I often see people in organizations claiming to know things that they don't. In a meeting, for instance, the more seasoned employees may use obscure acronyms, and the new recruits nod to signal that they are following the discussion when, in fact, they are not. They do so to make a good impression. But interestingly, when we are praised for behavior that is inauthentic, our self-esteem suffers. In one study, a group of college students first answered a questionnaire that measured their self-esteem, and then took one of two tests. One group took a test that could not be completed without the students pretending to understand several fake vocabulary words, such as visionary. The second group took a test in which no pretending to understand words was necessary. Once they completed the test, students in both groups received praise for their performance, and then answered questions about their self-esteem again. Those who had pretended experienced a loss in their self-esteem, while the others experienced gains. Inauthenticity can also make it tougher to land a job. Research conducted by Celia Moore of Bocconi University and her colleagues found that 92% of job candidates actively misrepresented themselves in interviews. That behavior has consequences. Those who are inauthentic, deflecting questions about weaknesses and concealing their personalities, are less likely to be hired. Much better is the path Anne Hathaway's character chose in The Devil Wears Prada. She lands a job at an elite fashion magazine, despite admitting she is neither skinny nor glamorous and has little interest in fashion. And if you're trying to raise money to launch a new business, it's best to be real. In a field study, my colleagues and I looked at data from 166 entrepreneurs participating in a fast-pitch competition. The three judges, experienced private investors interested in funding startup ventures, filled out a brief scorecard after each pitch. At the end of the event, they deliberated before choosing 10 semifinalists who would be invited to participate in the competition's final round. After making their pitch, entrepreneurs, at our request, answered two questions designed to reveal how much they were being themselves when presenting. Reflecting on the pitch you just delivered, to what extent do you feel you were being authentic? And reflecting on the pitch you just delivered, to what extent do you feel you were being genuine? When their responses were authentic, not just telling judges what they wanted to hear, the entrepreneurs were given higher ratings by the judges and had over three times higher odds of being one of the winners. Inauthenticity also works as a drag on motivation. I showed this in a study that will send a shiver down the spine of any Boston Red Sox fan. My colleague Mariam Kuchaki of Northwestern University and I recruited a group of Red Sox fans and gave half of them Red Sox wristbands to wear. The other half was stuck with New York Yankees wristbands. Then we had everyone put their dominant hand in a bucket of ice and measured how long they could last. The longer they endured, the more we'd pay them. Inauthenticity worked against those wearing the Yankees wristbands. Their times were lower. This is also true for social pain, the discomfort we experience when we feel excluded or rejected. In another study I ran with Kuchaki, we primed participants by asking them to recall a time when they felt either authentic or inauthentic. Next, we had them play a computer game called Cyberball, which involves tossing a virtual ball with two pre-programmed players. At first, the pair tossed the ball to each other and to the study participant. Then, suddenly, the pair started tossing the ball only to each other. Participants primed to feel authentic experienced much lower levels of psychological and physiological stress. Authenticity gives us the courage, energy, and confidence we need to rebound from negative experiences. It's also easier to be around. People can tell when we're being inauthentic. In fact, they register that inauthenticity in their bodies. When someone hides his feelings, those who interact with him experience a rise in blood pressure. This physiological response helps explain our discomfort around people who seem fake. This response is so strong that we actually prefer honest boasting to the dreaded humble brag, those phony complaints that provide an opportunity to brag about luck or talent. In other words, the friend who can't stop complaining about what a bad job she did applying to grad schools now that she can't keep up with all the acceptance letters she's received. My research shows that people disapprove of humble bragging even more than outright bragging. Nonetheless, it survives, even thrives. Having received the mixed message that it's impolite to brag and not safe to share our actual challenges with others, we fear being rejected and judged, and end up being rejected and judged. When Bottura opened Osteria Francescana in 1995, he met with considerable opposition from tradition-bound Italians. The chef told me, "It was more than resistance. They were actively fighting against us. They wanted to see us dead because they didn't want me to touch their grandmother's recipes." Bottura struggled to keep the restaurant alive in the early years. He persisted, though, in part thanks to lessons from his experience in the summer of 2000, when he worked at El Bulli, often described at the time as the best restaurant in the world. El Bulli chef Ferran Adrià taught Bottura that he had to stay true to himself. Bottura told me, "Right away I realized that it wasn't just about technique. What changed me was the message of freedom that Ferran gave me, the freedom to feel my own fire, to look inside myself and make my thoughts edible." He added, "Everybody looked at Ferran as the master of technique. To me, the most important focus of what he did is freedom. He gave us freedom to express ourselves in any way." Part of freedom is expressing oneself honestly. Even pretending to be happy can take a toll. I thought about this recently when I was visiting London's Victoria and Albert Museum, whose collection of decorative arts and design is the largest in the world. Two of the 4.5 million objects really got my attention, statues of Heraclitus and Democritus, Greek thinkers known as the weeping and laughing philosophers. Fittingly, Heraclitus looked sad and melancholic, while the cheerfulness on the face of Democritus brought a smile to my own. As many studies have found, we prefer people who appear happy. In research on speed dating, for instance, participants who appeared positive provoked uplifting emotions in others and were deemed better candidates for a second date. Yet we're not always going to be in a Democritus-like mood, and to pretend otherwise is folly. Dozens of studies on populations ranging from students to working adults show that inauthenticity exacts heavy costs on physical and emotional health. Among the negative consequences, sleep deprivation, headaches, and chest pain. Of course, for some of us, smiling at work isn't a matter of choice. When we board a plane or a bus, for example, we generally expect to be welcomed by flight attendants or bus drivers who are happy to see us. The problem is, sometimes they're really not. Across 2 weeks, 78 bus drivers working for a company in the northwestern United States took surveys before work, after their shifts, and just before they went to bed. They were asked about their sleep, their moods during and after work, and whether or not they had put on a performance or a mask that day. In the results, emotional acting was associated with insomnia, anxiety, and distress, and it also increased the likelihood of conflict at home. Meanwhile, drivers who reported behaving authentically, either by not faking smiles at all or by smiling because they felt genuinely happy, had much better sleep quality. Doctors and nurses are no strangers to pressure, but one fascinating study shows that having a safe space to express real feelings can make a big difference. Psychologist Alicia Grandy of Penn State and her colleagues collected survey data in different healthcare units in a large Australian hospital. One of their measures was the extent to which members of a medical team felt free to express real feelings to colleagues when the group was not dealing with patients or otherwise in the public eye. The idea was to capture how much of a climate of authenticity existed in a given group. When such a climate was present, members were better able to cope with tough situations, such as mistreatment by patients and their families. A climate of authenticity within a team, in fact, gave members a chance to replenish their emotional resources and recover from the harm of surface acting. Authenticity is a rule at Osteria Francescana. Once a week, Bottura asks team members to cook a dish from their own culture for the rest of the staff. This tradition allows the cook to tell his or her stories, and it also reveals different ways of using the same ingredients. One morning, as workers polished dishes and cutlery, an intern with a degree in art history showed them pictures of paintings and talked in detail about the ideas behind the brushstrokes. Why did he do this? Because Bottura had kept asking him to be himself and bring more of himself into work. Bottura pushed other interns to do the same, as well as everyone else working at Osteria. And as each member of the staff found their way to be unique in the kitchen and in the front of the house, the dishes at Osteria became more refined and delicious. In 2001, one of Italy's most prominent food writers got stuck in traffic on his way from Rome to Milan and stopped in at Osteria Francescana for a meal. A rave review followed. Within a year, the first Michelin star arrived. It was only the beginning. It's a curious reality that most large organizations manage their employees based on weakness. Just think about how performance reviews typically work. Gaps between ideal behaviors and actual ones are identified, and feedback follows. Thanks to feedback, the employee gains a sense of where he's failing and then starts to think about making improvements. It's true that feedback sometimes covers strengths, but none of us escape the negativity bias or the tendency for negative information, thoughts, emotions, and experiences to make a more lasting impression on us. When we give feedback to others, we often focus on the problems that performance reviews identify rather than on words of praise or encouragement. Even outside of work, when we think about self-improvement, we tend to focus on weaknesses. Consider the usual suspects in New Year's resolutions: get healthy, lose weight, spend less, get organized. These goals have the feel of a negative job review. You're just not cutting it. A study conducted by psychologists Andreas Steimer of Universitat Heidelberg and Andre Mata of the ISPA Instituto Universitario revealed one of the primary reasons that we tend to focus on weaknesses as opposed to strengths. Participants were told to list a personality trait that they really liked, a strength, and another that they really disliked, a weakness. Next, they answered questions aimed at determining how changeable they believed these traits to be. The results showed that people generally believed their weaknesses to be more malleable than their strengths. In fact, we've got it backward. We improve faster in areas where we are strong than in areas where we are weak. Research on self-efficacy shows that we are more motivated towards self-improvement when we are confident of results, and more likely to think that our efforts will produce good outcomes when we focus on our strengths rather than our weaknesses. One of the best reasons to focus on our strengths is that doing so encourages us to be authentic and allows our true selves to shine. Think of how coaches work with professional athletes. They might do some work on weaknesses, but mostly they build on areas of tremendous skill. A study conducted decades ago unintentionally proved this idea. In the 1950s, the Nebraska School Study Council commissioned statewide research that included a test of a method for teaching rapid reading to 10th graders. Before the course, the students were reading, on average, about 90 words per minute. After it, they had improved to about 150 words per minute. But there was a group who had made much larger gains, the students who were strongest at the outset. Before the training, these super readers were covering 300 words per minute. After the course, they jumped to about 2,900 words per minute. Some of the greatest gains in human development may come from investing in what people naturally do best. In 2013, Deloitte decided to get rid of its performance management system. Deloitte is one of the Big Four accounting corporations and the world's largest professional services network, with more than $35 billion in revenue and 244,000 employees. Their old process was in many ways typical, Managers set objectives for each employee and then rated the employees on how well those objectives were met. These evaluations formed the basis for annual ratings that were set at consensus meetings, where counselors represented employees to discuss where each of them stood in comparison to their coworkers. There were preset categories for the ratings, which were required to conform to a force distribution. This is what determined any changes in compensation. Company leaders worried that the company was failing in the ultimate goal of developing stronger employees and leaders. In addition, the performance review cycle, which included filling out forms, participating in meetings, and doing the actual ratings, took about 1.8 million hours a year. Most of this time seemed to be consumed by discussions of ratings rather than being used productively to talk to employees about their performance and potential. Deloitte replaced the system with one aimed at investing in employees for the long term. There would still be performance reviews, but they would be streamlined. The new system redistributed time and energy to coaching, more timely feedback, and career guidance. The emphasis across all these activities would be on strengths, not weaknesses. Each employee would be assigned a coach to help him or her discover and apply strengths and make sense of feedback. In 2014, Deloitte ran a small pilot to test the new system. 600 U.S. workers participated. The initiative was such a success that the company soon ran a larger pilot on about 7,000 people. Data from the two pilots indicated that participants performed better, felt greater commitment to the organization, and became more energized in their work. These trends became more pronounced the longer the employees participated in the new system. The data also found that one predictor of job performance stood above all others, playing to strengths. By the end of 2017, about 85,000 Deloitte employees were working under the new process. In a multi-year study of team performance Gallup conducted involving more than 1.4 million employees working in 50,000 teams across 192 organizations, high-performing teams and lower-performing ones responded to statements related to purpose, pay, and opportunity. A small group of items explained most of the variation between the two types of teams. The most powerful was a measure of applied aptitude. At work, I have the opportunity to do what I do best every day. Teams whose members chose strongly agree as a response to this item were 38% more productive, 50% more likely to have low turnover, and 44% more likely to have high customer satisfaction scores. But the introspection of a firm like Deloitte is rare. As organizations grow, they often lose sight of what made them successful in the first place, their employees. In a survey I conducted of about 280 students who attended executive education classes at HBS, I found that larger organizations were less likely to treat investing in people as a priority. It can be easy to forget about all the talent in the room, especially as a company grows and demands that its top leaders grow with it. Focus turns to investments in other markets, products or services, and in new technologies and equipment. All the while, potential investments in employees are neglected, and huge opportunities are squandered. According to Gallup research, people who use their strengths daily are 6 times more likely to get satisfaction out of their job and report less stress and anxiety. Research by the Corporate Leadership Council found that when managers focus on an employee's weaknesses, his or her performance declines by 27%, whereas a focus on strengths boosts performance by 36%. Similar data from Gallup suggests that employees develop better relationships with their managers and are more likely to improve and feel energized at work when their bosses focus on their strengths. When strengths are brought to the foreground, the employee's focus shifts from worrying about what others think they should be to becoming the best version of who they truly are. It can be incredibly empowering to figure out what we're good at. We are stuck in our own heads 24/7, but we don't often see ourselves or take time to examine our strengths. In a study I conducted with Julia Lee of the University of Michigan, Dan Cable of London Business School, and Brad Stotts of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, Participants provided us with contact information for various people in their professional and personal networks, including family members, friends, and coworkers. We reached out to the people the participants had listed and asked them to write a story about a time when they had witnessed the participant at his or her best and to share it with us. Each participant received 5 to 10 stories that were overwhelmingly and often unexpectedly positive. Consider this narrative about a boss, with names changed for privacy reasons. Laura has good forethought for business and does anything and everything she can to help keep us employed. In 2012, when Hurricane Sandy hit the East Coast, here in Florida, we did not really think much of it. But Laura was obviously worried that it would impact her business, because a lot of our accounts receivables are in the New York City, New Jersey areas. She ended up borrowing from her retirement savings to keep the business going. I even suggested that maybe she could let the couple of part-timers go, but she responded that the people there always gave their best, so she wouldn't want to do anything less for them. It took about 6 months to get things back on track, but we all managed to keep our jobs, thanks to Laura. We gave half of our participants the narratives about them and asked them to read through them and identify the strengths the stories highlighted. We then divided participants into teams and had them engage in tasks that would allow us to measure their performance. Those who had read about their strengths before the exercise were less concerned about being socially accepted by their team members, and as a result, their teams exchanged more information and achieved higher performance. This is the power of self-reflection. It instills the confidence we need to accomplish our goals. Back in 2011, the Indian IT company Wipro was experiencing some tough issues in its business process outsourcing division. The company was spending a lot of money training people, only to see them leave within 2 months. To understand why, my colleagues Dan Cable, Brad Stotz, and I talked to the employees. Workers told us that the organization was asking them to strip away their identities and not allowing them to play to their strengths. So we conducted a field experiment designed to encourage self-reflection and measure its effects. We had some of Wipro's incoming employees go through a new onboarding process where we asked them to spend a designated half hour thinking about what was unique about them, what their strengths were, and how they could bring out more of themselves authentically at work. 7 months later, these employees had found ways to tailor their jobs to their strengths. For example, they used their own judgment and words when answering customer calls, instead of strictly following the firm's script. They were more committed to their jobs, performed at higher levels, and were more likely to still be at Wipro, all thanks to a half-hour reflection exercise. In another study at the company, we asked a group of employees who were going through training to spend their last 15 minutes at the office each day reflecting, in writing, on the lessons they had learned that day. Over the course of a month, reflection increased performance on the final training test by an average of 23%. Self-reflection can have significant effects over time. When Rachel Chong was working as a young investment banker, she participated in a volunteer opportunity with a group of other bankers, in which they all helped to build a house in the Bronx. One day, as Chong, who is 5'2", was slowly hauling lumber across the construction yard, she realized that this task was not exactly making the best use of her strengths, or of those of the other bankers. Why, she wondered, are bankers building houses when they could be using their unique skills to build financial models for nonprofits that desperately need that type of help? Fired up, she spent several months looking for an alternative way to volunteer her skills, but came up empty. A year later, Chong moved to Bangladesh to help launch the U.S. affiliate of BRAC, or Building Resources Across Communities, one of the largest nonprofit organizations in the world. 11 college students had come along to serve as BRAC volunteers. The students learned about microfinance and worked on projects pro bono. More important, they developed a deep, lasting appreciation for helping others. By watching the students, Chong told me when I interviewed her, she realized that a good experience opens a mind to possibilities of how much you could achieve as an individual. When you volunteer, you may think, am I really making a dent in big problems? A good volunteer experience would lead you to feel yes. Chong started thinking that volunteering could be an activity that empowered people, inspiring them to do more. For this to happen, they would have to be involved in activities that energized them, work they believed they were good at. In time, Chong founded Catch a Fire, a firm that connects professionals who want to donate their skills with nonprofit and social enterprises that need help. She borrowed the name from a Bob Marley album. Songs like Stir It Up, Chong says, provide a nice parallel to what volunteering should be about. She says, it's about finding fire in yourself. Volunteering, in her mind, should help people find their spark and make the best use of their passion. I saw the angel in the marble, and I carved it until I set him free. This is how Michelangelo Buonarroti, the legendary artist behind the Pietà in Rome and the David in Florence, described the process of sculpting in a 1547 letter to famed Italian humanist Benedetto Varchi. For Michelangelo, sculpture was a process in which the artist allows an ideal figure to be released from the block of stone in which it slumbers. All of us possess such ideal forms within ourselves, our signature strengths. Our task is to find ways to sculpt work and life to bring out our uniqueness. Every day we have opportunities to be naked in front of our colleagues, to make ourselves vulnerable, and to be more open about discussing our mistakes. We can also make time to reflect on what our signature strengths may be so that we can make use of them more often. There is no need to wait for a nudge from the boss. We can start the process ourselves. But leaders have an important role to play. Melody Hobson is the president of Ariel Investments, a Chicago-based money management firm. When she first joined the company right after graduating from college at 22, she was given license to be herself. As she told me, I received precious and unforgettable advice on my first day at work from Ariel's founder and CEO, John W. Rogers, Jr. He said to me, you are going to be in rooms with people who make a lot of money and have big titles, but it does not mean your ideas are not as good or even better. I want to hear your ideas. It is incumbent on you to speak up. Hobson has told that story many, many times since then, because to hear it is a gift, she believes. Last year, in the process of hiring a person who is now part of the company's research team, Hobson told the candidate she expected her to be a source of spark in the conversation and a source of difference to really push us and to say the uncomfortable thing. If you want to see this type of attitude in the organization, Hobson believes, you can't be shy about letting people know. When we play to our strengths and find ways to be authentic at work, we feel more committed to the organization we work for and experience more joy in our pursuits. There's a video I like to show to my students that opens with a little boy strutting through a backyard, toting a ball and bat and wearing his baseball cap. I'm the greatest hitter in the world, he announces. Then he tosses the ball into the air, a swing and a miss. Strike one, he yells. Undaunted, he picks up the ball and again says, I'm the greatest hitter in the world. He tosses the ball in the air, only to whiff again. Strike two, he cries out. The boy carefully examines the bat and the ball. He spits on his hands and rubs them together. He straightens his cap and says once again, I'm the greatest hitter in the world. He throws the ball in the air. He swings. He misses. Strike three. He pauses, confused. Then he exclaims, wow, I'm the greatest pitcher in the world. And he smiles. This is the smile of finding your strength. Chapter 7, The Secret of Story, The Transformative Power of Engagement. To win in the marketplace, you must first win in the workplace. Doug Conant. It's 6:36 a.m. I've boarded a plane at Boston's Logan Airport and am waiting anxiously in my seat. The pilot comes on to make an announcement, and I sigh with relief. The heavy snow that was expected has been downgraded to just a few flakes, so our flight is on schedule. I'm headed to Newark for a full day of teaching. As the final few passengers take their seats, a flight attendant begins the boarding announcement. Ladies and gentlemen, the captain has turned on the fasten seatbelt sign. If you haven't already done so, please stow your carry-on luggage underneath the seat in front of you or in an overhead bin. She continues on about emergency exits and smoke detectors, but my thoughts turn to the classes I'll be teaching. I am planning a group exercise for 40 executives, and I wonder whether the directions are clear enough. The plane door closes, and the flight attendant launches into another announcement. Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Jennifer Capstone, and I'm your chief flight attendant. On behalf of the captain and the entire crew, welcome aboard United Airlines Flight 343, nonstop service from Boston to Newark. As she tells us about the flight time, altitude, and speed, my mind again wanders. I scribble a few notes on the day's first teaching session. The flight attendants position themselves for the safety demonstration. I look up for a moment, but my gaze quickly returns to my notes. Soon, we're airborne. A few other announcements drift by during the flight, but none really register. It seems we've barely reached peak altitude when the plane starts to descend for landing. I make it to my class with plenty of time to spare, and I begin with an exercise where I auction off a $100 bill to my students. I explain to them that both the highest and second highest bidders will have to pay for their bids, but only the person with the highest bid will win the money. Bids start at $5 and go up $5 at a time. I don't allow them to talk to one another, and I ask them to just shout out their bids. As I start the auction, many students raise their hands when they want in. The price of the bids is fast increasing, and when we get close to $100, just two of the executives keep on bidding. They seem to realize that the lower bidder will be stuck having to pay, so neither is willing to drop out. They end up bidding well over $100 for that $100 bill. The highest bid? $360. The second highest was $355. This turns out to be a good way to begin a discussion about common errors that affect our decision-making. The auction, in fact, shows the students that our decisions are often irrational. In the end, I don't pocket the money I made. I give it back to the group so they can buy themselves some drinks after class. I am not cruel. At 5 p.m., I'm sitting on my return flight to Boston. Ladies and gentlemen, the captain has turned on the fasten seatbelt sign. From the time they are hired, flight attendants learn a variety of procedures that they must follow to the letter. They are trained to deal with everything from medical emergencies to hostile passengers, and they know how to use every piece of emergency equipment on the plane, from the first aid kit to the life rafts to the fire extinguishers. These measures are vital to the safety of everybody on board, and it is certainly helpful to know how to access and use the oxygen mask in case of an emergency, or to be reminded to turn off electronic devices that could interfere with the flight. But all of this safety information rarely registers with me when I am on a plane, as I'm sure is the case with most passengers. As a customer, then, I'm less safe when I tune out during these announcements than I would be if they weren't so scripted and I was actually listening. And imagine what these announcements are like for flight attendants. Repeating the same exact words on every flight, using the same exact hand movements, they show a group of strangers how to fasten their seatbelts and the right way to put on a life jacket. Almost mindlessly, they point to each of the exits and remind passengers not to smoke in the lavatories. And they can probably tell from the faces of those on board that their words and gestures are not capturing anyone's attention. With so much of their job scripted, it's bound to get both boring and frustrating. The quandary of the flight attendant is a familiar one, faced by workers in every kind of job. Most people don't show up for their first day at a new job feeling unmotivated, frustrated, and uninspired. Rather, they are excited to get started, ready to meet new colleagues, hopeful they'll make a good impression. Yet the honeymoon period typically soon comes to an end. Data that my colleagues and I have collected from a wide range of industries reveals that people feel high levels of energy, commitment, and excitement in the first few days of their new jobs, followed by a noticeable drop within the first year. It doesn't matter whether it's a first job or how many alternatives they had to choose from, the decline seems inevitable. Excitement turns into boredom. The desire to bring one's best self to work slackens into a tendency to just go with the flow. After announcing that the captain has turned on the fasten seatbelt sign for the 100th time, the thrill is gone. Since 1998, the Gallup organization has been studying engagement at work by surveying millions of employees across industries and nations. According to data collected by Gallup in 2016, only 32% of U.S. employees feel involved in, enthusiastic